Welcome to the Raging Rhino Podcast. This is podcast number 78. My name is John. Beelzebub has a devil put aside for me. Okay, few quick notes before I begin the podcast. The most beautiful woman in the world, my wife and occasional podcast partner, Gina, had a bit of a mishap a few days ago. She missed the last step coming down the stairs, landed awkwardly, and injured her foot. I'm happy to say that we just found out, despite early concerns from the orthopedic specialist, she will not require surgery, and she can immediately begin putting occasional moderate weight on the foot. But she's going to be in a cast for the next 4 weeks, and then a walking boot after that, for four more. I'm saying this because if you feel like wishing her well, please go ahead and do so. Also, making sure she is tended to properly will be my priority, and that might delay the podcast next month. I made a promise to myself that I would do at least a 30-minute podcast every month, so if I miss some time, I will make it up with two podcasts in the same month in the near future. I mean, look at the imbeciles the two major political parties are foisting before the nation. It's not like there won't be plenty of idiocy to comment on. Second, news came over on Monday that Gene Wilder passed away. I can't tell you how many times his work made me smile. Young Frankenstein is one of my all-time favorites, and of course that's just the tip of the iceberg with him. I'm absolutely going to watch Young Frankenstein this weekend, though. I don't know if there's a God. I don't know if there's an afterlife. But if there is, I hope somewhere right now, Gilda Radner and Gene Wilder are at the beginning of a very, very long embrace. Third, there are three podcasts, other than my own, that I cannot miss an episode, and I want to give one of them a quick shout out. Thank you very much to the Blatcast, not only for giving me something to listen to and enjoy on my daily commute home, but to Christian Blatt at ChristianDMZ for the nice tweet about podcast number 74, and to Will Sterling, at @WillSterling_, for being the choir to my preaching about the critical hypocrisy of DC Comics movies. So, cheers to you guys. If you're ever in San Antonio, drinks are on me. Same goes for Captain EO, at Jeff DeRay, Coltrane, at Coltrane Leaks, and Liev. Hashtag Liev no longer on Twitter. Sip of whiskey. If you listen to this podcast, you know it is primarily political. At least, that's how it's been for most of its 6.5 years. I know pop culture is a bane for some of the more hardcore political junkies. Pop culture is a distraction from the important issues. If you're that heavily into politics and how they affect our lives, I can understand why you would feel that way about pop culture. On the other hand, get the stick out of your ass. I'm the kind of guy who will crack jokes at a funeral. Why? Because if I don't, I will be so overwhelmed with grief, I couldn't function. The same with politics. If I don't temper it with some unimportant distraction, I will collapse in a morass of depression. Because politics really sucks sometimes. Most of the time. All of the time. Politics pretty much sucks all the time. So, since another DC Comics movie has debuted, I'm going to split this podcast into part pop culture and part politics. But here's the fun part. You know how sometimes you'll get a movie soundtrack with music that's not in the movie? I don't know how much that happens these days with downloads, but I remember it happening occasionally when I was growing up, especially for really popular movies. I guess they were just trying to ride some coattails. But if you remember soundtracks like that, you'll remember the caveat, music inspired by. That's what I'm going to do here. I'm going to start with a little talk about the Suicide Squad, and then I'm going to do some political commentary that came to mind while thinking about the movie. Now, just like with the Batman vs. Superman political commentary that I did a few months back, I don't think there is any specific political message the movies were trying or intending to convey. I'm not trying to put words into anybody's mouth. These are just my musings, inspired by certain moments or ideas from the film, filtered through my libertarian-leaning mind. So, Suicide Squad. I'm gonna spoil the fuck out of this movie. So, if you haven't seen it yet, go and do it, and then get back here when you're done. Not if you want to see it, you just go see it. Just go see the goddamn movie already. There's only two guaranteed ways to get me into a movie theater these days. One is the frequent Riff Trax live shows. Carnival of Souls is coming out for Halloween. I highly recommend getting tickets. The other is a DC Comics movie. If you've listened to previous podcasts, especially the past year, where I've delved more into pop culture, you know this already. Here's the funny thing. I wasn't much into Suicide Squad in my younger days. I'm more of a Secret Six kind of guy when it comes to villain teams. I would probably enjoy Jon Ostrander's work now that I'm older, and I can appreciate the clandestine government operations aspect of their stories. But when they debuted in my mid-teens, I wasn't ready for the more nuanced stories. I liked the individual characters. Oh, hell, I used to have the Fury of Firestorm issue where Slipknot debuted. And yes, given the character, it doesn't surprise me a bit that he is the first to die. And, yes, he really only did die to prove that there's a bomb implanted in your neck. I told you they were spoilers. Let me talk about what I didn't like right up front, because I really want to focus on the positives, so I'll get the negatives out of the way. I didn't like the antagonists. The fact that Enchantress turns on everybody is not surprising. But, along with her brother having such high-level, powerful enemies, with supernatural, almost godlike powers, it seems like a pretty poor mismatch. So, they take out the brother, again, with supernatural, almost godlike powers, with a bomb. And not a very big one either. How can these beings have so much power, yet a low-level explosion kills them? Both Incubus and El Diablo, who's caught in the blast, feel like they have enough power to survive an explosion, even in their weakened states. So now the only character on your team with powers anywhere close to the bad guy's level is seemingly killed, taking out the brother, leaving a cast of human characters to go up against the Enchantress, who should have easily taken them all out. I mean, yes, they have Katana's supernatural sword, which does help remove the witch's heart. But the same powerful sorceress who could read everybody's minds to give them the illusion of the perfect lives they could lead, couldn't read Harley's mind that she was about to be double-crossed? It bugged me a little bit. But of course not enough to make me dislike the movie. So once again, I go into a DC Comics movie and come out not understanding why critics vehemently dislike it. I'm not one of those schmucks calling for Rotten Tomatoes to be investigated, but I do admit there's a little part of me that's starting to wonder if maybe some of these critics have ties to the Disney Corporation. Marvel. I don't understand why some critics complained about the disjointed storytelling. I'm sorry, kiddos, but if you can't handle a few flashbacks and character fleshouts, then maybe you need to talk to your doctor to see if Adderall is right for you. And if you still can't handle disjointed storytelling, I better not catch your glowing review of Pulp Fiction. I think my favorite nitpick complaint was about the Joker lying amongst carefully patterned weapons, and how it seemed silly and obsessive. Okay, first off, you're complaining that the Joker is being obsessive? Second, do you not remember Jack Nicholson's Joker cutting out hundreds of pictures of Vicki Vale in Tim Burton's first Batman film? I'm gonna bet you had no quibbles about that. There's a lot to like about this film. Hell, even in the trailers, I love the colors all over the place. But you still felt uneasy about these odd, dangerous characters. And I felt that way throughout the movie. And you're supposed to. Like Harley says, we're the bad guys. You're not supposed to be comfortable around a psychotic clown or a half-crocodile, half-human cannibal. But the best part about that is the most cold-blooded of them all is not the ones you would consider the freaks, but the government agent who puts the team together. Gina likes the TV show How to Get Away with Murder. When I heard Viola Davis had been cast as Amanda Waller, I asked Gina, can she play a ruthless bitch? Gina assured me she could, and Davis sure as hell did. The Suicide Squad is tasked with infiltrating a dangerous area to rescue a high-value asset at the top of a skyscraper. The asset turns out to be Waller herself, holed up with some underlings who had been helping her trying to find a way to stop the Enchantress. As soon as their info is either secured or destroyed, Waller takes out a gun and calmly, yet swiftly, kills each one of the underlings. Why? They didn't have clearance. They knew too much. If anything, I could have used a little more time with that character just to see Viola Davis act. I like that pretty much every character got at least a brief moment in the spotlight. El Diablo was certainly the most surprising of the characters, as you see his backstory as the egotistical, powerful gang member, then to the cursed, contrite prisoner he's become when he's called to join the mission. Because of that, he's probably the one you root for the most, which makes his supposed death all the more tragic. And yes, I said supposed death. This is, after all, a comic book movie. Deadshot and Harley Quinn get the most attention, which makes sense because of the stars playing them. Gina says that Margot Robbie is her new girl crush. I can't say I blame her. She's a lovely woman. I actually liked her best in the car chase flashback. That, to me, felt like the heart of the character. I love the cameos by Batman and Flash. Glad that each of these characters brings down the villain or villains that are most closely associated with the hero. Love that the building was named after John Ostrander. And as with Batman vs. Superman, I love that the credits end with recognition for the people who created the individual characters and the Suicide Squad concept. I know some people were put off by this version of the Joker. He was definitely unlike any previous movie incarnation. But that's what I like most about him. There's a creepy sexual aspect to Jared Leto's performance. And that's been explored in more recent years in the comic books on Scott Snyder's run. And that creepy sexuality really comes out, no pun intended, in the scene where Joker confronts the prison guard to get him to deliver the phone to Harley. Joker sticks out his hand in front of the guard, and the guard realizes he's meant to kiss the ring, literally, on Joker's finger. After he does, Joker jumps in his lap and says with equal parts flirtation and mania, "I can tell you really meant that." Ooh, just enough to make your skin crawl. I loved it. There were also complaints that he was not in the movie enough, and I can understand that. I wanted more of him in the movie, but if you do that, then it's no longer a Suicide Squad movie. Joker, after all, is meant to be a wild card, and that's how the movie plays him. Yes, there was more humor than Batman vs. Superman, and yes, that's a good thing. But I also think it better serves these characters to crack jokes and deliver smart-ass quips. I think when it comes to the disconnect between critics and fans, there are two types of critics who have been so set against this movie. There are the critics who are too far removed from the characters, so they have no knowledge or understanding of why this team of misfits works so well. Second, you have the critics who are too close to the characters and adamantly refuse to accept them unless the plot is some storyline ripped directly from a specific comic book or the characters absolutely must have a certain look or style. For example, Harley in the Jester costume, which you got a peek at in the homage to the classic Alex Ross cover, but thankfully, that was not the main costume used. As far as I'm concerned, that thing belongs in the cartoon, not in live action. I think there are reasons why critics like these don't like DC's current series of movies. The first reason is they're too damn hung up on the nostalgia of the Christopher Reeve Superman quadrilogy. That they can't get past the aw shucks clumsy nerdy Clark Kent and the squeaky clean always wins and always does everything perfect superhero. They prefer the milquetoast Disney-fied cookie cutter universe. They will gladly forgive weak movies in lieu of a charismatic actor. Let's be honest. Other than Robert Downey Jr., was there anything great about Iron Man? Think about it. Take out the charismatic actor, and that movie never becomes a blockbuster. The Avengers movie? How dumb is it that nobody catches on that Loki obviously meant to be caught? Not even his brother. But again, you've got Robert Downey Jr. and Samuel L. Jackson, two of the most charismatic actors of their generation. Plus, pretty boys Chris Hemsworth and Chris Evans. Plus, Scarlett Johansson in a skin-tight outfit. And who the fuck cares if they so easily captured a demigod? Or let a rampaging green monster tear haphazardly through a city? Or let giant alien creatures crash into buildings while thousands of other aliens maniacally fire at the people. This is Marvel. So despite the carnage, miraculously, no one died. Except for Coulson. Oh, wait. Look, I'm sorry. Honestly, I used to not give a damn about all that until people started shitting all over the movies of my favorite characters. Now, I'm feeling a little defensive. Uh-oh. You smell that? It smells like the transition from pop culture to politics. So, if you're listening just for the pop culture, feel free to bail. I understand. More whiskey. So, yes, there is definitely a disconnect between the critics who supposedly know what is good and what the people like and want. I mentioned this in a recent podcast, but I'll do it again here. Over the past several years, there have been two seemingly grassroots movements: Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party. Now, you can argue all you want about whether either of these is a legitimate grassroots movement, and you can debate about their true intentions. However, their stated goals are, respectively, less corporatism and less intrusive government. That's what the people want. So what have the two major parties given us for candidates? They give us the poster boy for corporatism in Donald Trump, and the epitome of bigger, more intrusive government in Hillary Clinton. There's what the people want, and then there's what the so-called experts tell us we should have. They prefer the status quo to anything that might challenge them intellectually. They don't want to face the facts that real change involves making hard choices and dealing with dirty situations. That's too challenging. That's too real. So they're happy with hiding in the vacuous comfort of a big government party that gives us the illusion of choice. It doesn't matter which big government party is in power. The United States is still invading foreign countries. We're still toppling governments and watching their former leaders being executed. We still send troops on missions in countries that are supposed to be our allies without telling them what we're doing. Our government still tells us they're winning without giving us any real proof that it's true. On the home front, government still controls the definition of marriage. Government still controls what we can and cannot put into our bodies. The privileged commit crimes but evade prosecution because they control the system or they know the right people. We are commanded to make sacrifices via taxes and lifestyle changes, while the people who champion the sacrifices make no change but reap all the benefits. Our debt still grows, the beast ever increasing in strength, and we applaud when the government tells us they're spending slightly less than they used to. We prefer the illusion of the pretty little America projected to us by big government liars because we don't want to face the shambles that they're making of it. We don't want to admit that we were wrong to trust these charlatans. And it's led us to the option of which Batman villain we want to vote for, the Joker or Two-Face. One other thing I want to point out before I head back to the theater to see Suicide Squad a third time. I mentioned earlier that Enchantress, the witch, turns on them. Let me clarify. Waller thinks she controls Enchantress, but the witch hatches a scheme to sneak away briefly and get help from her brother Incubus. This then leads her to breaking free completely and causing the havoc in the movie. The government uses the Suicide Squad against a threat of their own making. Now, there are dozens of ways you could look at this, but let me just give you a few examples of the government making the problem. We are currently in a prolonged military conflict with radical Islamists. Our Peace Prize winning president has done nothing for peace in his near 8 years in office. We are still sending soldiers off to die in battles in Muslim countries. Even ally countries without their knowledge. And there's no end in sight. And you can blame Bush for starting it because of 9/11. And you could blame Clinton for not taking care of Osama bin Laden when he had the chance. But you can easily trace this all the way back to the United States and Great Britain overthrowing the Iranian government in the early 1950s. Hell, I've heard Dan Carlin trace it back to World War I, and he knows history far better than I do. Our interference caused this. Our continued interference and military incursions, be it from troops on the ground in Republican administrations or drone strikes under the current Democrat administration, it's only breeding more hatred. That hatred will continue to grow against us until our defenses again fail and we are attacked and citizens die. This is a chance to break that deadly cycle and turn back to our non-interventionist roots. Another example. It used to be, if you were sick, your local doctor came to your house and treated you. Since then, it has devolved into you going to a centralized waiting area where you can spread and share your germs and the germs of others. I was talking with a coworker last week about a couple of friends she has over in Europe with their vaunted government healthcare. One is going to have to wait for more than a year for a necessary surgery. Another has been refused treatment because she's a smoker. Sorry, we don't like the way you live your life, so we're going to let you die. And that's the kind of care they want us to have. Ooh, conspiracy theory. Well, either that, or actually seeing an interview with Barack Obama years before he hit the national spotlight, saying his endgame is to force the United States into a single-payer healthcare scheme, just like the ones they have in Europe. What has changed from the time of the doctor's house call? Layers and layers of bureaucracy and government intervention, each time under the guise of fixing some problem only to make it worse. How much does that bureaucracy add to the cost of health care? How much does this latest level of bureaucracy add to it? Hell, it's gotten so bad, Aetna's pulling out of Texas. But why would the bureaucrats care? They're still getting paid. Okay, one more. Take a look at some of the old movies, especially ones where you have somebody walking down the street past a market or a grocer. And you'll probably see a sign something like, bread, 5 cents. 5 cents for a loaf of bread. These days, even the cheap shit is what, $1.50? At least that's what it is here in Texas. What happened? Is there a shortage of wheat or milk or eggs or yeast to cause the price to rise? No. If anything, those things are now more plentiful. Has the machinery to produce and transport the bread to market changed? If anything, technology has made the mass production and transportation easier. So what the hell has changed in the past 100 years to cause the price of bread to increase 30-fold? Well, there's taxes and bureaucracy from both Republican and Democrat administrations and legislation, forced artificial wage increases, taxation on every conceivable aspect of the product, bureaucratic regulations that give a false sense of security that government is carefully watching over us and making sure the product is safe. Layers on top of more layers, making our life more expensive, coupled with the removal of the gold standard on our currency, devaluing our dollar by 93%. And now they want to add the value-added tax that will increase the price at every step of the process, from the raw materials to the finished product in your pantry? That's crazy. That's what government has done with their interference. And those examples are just the proverbial tip of the iceberg. This is what we are doing to ourselves by electing these people. This is what happens when we let the politicians and the bureaucrats take control of our lives. This is what happens when we misplace our trust in them. All they care about is gaining and retaining power. They will keep stealing the rights away from others, and you'll let them because you think they champion your rights. But they don't care about you. They care about your vote. As long as you only care about your rights, and to hell with your neighbor's rights, this will keep happening. And if you don't care about somebody else losing his or her freedoms, why should anyone care if you lose yours? We can either admit that we are wrong or continue to live in denial. So go ahead. Vote Democrat or Republican, and the wars will continue, and healthcare will become more and more bureaucratic, and the cost of living will continue to skyrocket as our currency will lose its value. But the warning signs are here. If we keep letting our politicians do this in our name, it's not just crazy. It's suicide. This is the Raging Rhino Podcast. You'll hear from me again.